Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. We're a local chapter of the National Speleological Society, a national organization dedicated to the education about and exploration and preservation of caves. If that's something you're interested in, visit their website, caves.org. You can find your local grotto there. Find out when they meet, go to a meeting, make some friends, get underground yourself. Caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. So find people who do it and tag along. Most of us are happy to share. And speaking of not knowing what you're doing, there was a rescue in a cave that we've actually talked about on the podcast. If you remember the Scott McRae episode, he's, of course, the founder of Swego. And among his big discoveries is Cyclops Cave in Virginia, which was the site of a big but successful rescue this past weekend. Since then, there's been a lot of media attention, mostly positive, especially with respect to the rescuers. There was also the issue of permission. Apparently, the folks who got into the cave didn't have permission from the landowner, which, as you know, is so important. It also seems they weren't particularly prepared to be in this cave, which is a very difficult cave that also requires vertical gear and a certain degree of proficiency. I'm just glad that cavers came to the rescue and everyone got out okay. Most importantly, lessons were learned. For that matter, a big congratulations to everyone involved in the Mill Pond rescue of Josh Bratchley in Tennessee. So glad to see two good rescue outcomes within less than 2 weeks of each other. Real quick calendar note. Sarah is this weekend at the Lazy G Wedding Chapel in Union Grove, Alabama. I want to go. I've gotten a lot of invites from people saying, come down to tag. But I'm already committed to another trip this weekend a little closer to home. But if the weather sucks here and looks good there, I'll see you down there. We'll just have to wait and see. But if you're down for a spur-of-the-moment trip to tag this weekend, do it. If you need more info, you can find it at huntsvillegrotto.net. So if you've listened for a while, you know that Organic Robot has been a sponsor of the show. It's my buddy Charlie Vetters, who's in my grotto and on the board. This isn't really a sponsor mention, but I just want to let you know he's entering the Caving Podcast t-shirt into the NSS Convention t-shirt salon, which is pretty cool. I don't know if it'll win, but it'd be nice if it did. He's going to be at SpeleoFest Memorial Day weekend. And if you've looked at what he has on his Etsy site and you think, I've seen it all, he's got more designs, specifically caving designs, coming soon on a variety of garments, and he'll have them at SpeleoFest. And he'll be at convention in Tennessee in June as well. And the first 200 people at convention who ask for one get a free Caving Podcast sticker. You don't even have to buy anything. He'll also have Caving Podcast t-shirts. Half of those proceeds come to me to help pay my bills. And I do have some bills for bandwidth and hosting and whatnot. So yeah, visit with Charlie at SpeleoFest and convention and get a sticker and a few shirts from Organic Robot Designs. So a listener turned supporter of the podcast asked that each month I highlight a different karst conservancy. And this month I've decided to talk about the Mid-Atlantic Karst Conservancy out of Pennsylvania. First thing I noticed about them was their great URL, karst.org. That's it. Easy to remember, karst.org. Anyway, they're closing on a new property at the end of this month, May 31st. Sarah Furnace Cave was popular with cavers decades ago, but the property was closed in 1992. People still went, but responsible cavers who asked permission, again, the importance of permission, did not go. A few years ago, the property changed hands and permission was granted on a limited basis, and a few trips were organized. So cavers got to know this cave again, and last year the property went up for sale, and now we're less than a month away from the Mid-Atlantic Karst Conservancy owning the cave and allowing more access to cavers. Here's the thing, though. They need to raise the remaining funds. They're looking for about 10 grand. Website says 30 grand. I got some good news last night. It's only 10 grand left. So if you've ever wanted to help a conservancy acquire a great cave in a big way, get a hold of them. Again, you can go to karst.org. I love that web address. Or you can email their treasurer, Johnny Motto, at treasurer@karst.org. Could it get any easier to remember? 10 grand by the end of the month. We can do it. Mid-Atlantic Karst Conservancy and Sarah Furnace Cave in Clarion County, Pennsylvania. Thanks for your support of this great conservancy. Okay, now to my guest this month. I think this was one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. Of course, lately, I've had a lot of Skype and phone guests, which are great because I get to talk with people who have a national reputation that way. But it's always nice to sit down with someone in person, and that's what I got to do with Rusty. Rusty Riley is a member of my grotto, and he's done so much in his long caving life. We talk a lot about Two-Bit Pit, which I talked about with Greg McNamara, but Rusty's story is a lot of fun because he wasn't exactly prepared for the cave's rigors the first time he went in, which is always good for a great story. Early on in the conversation, we kind of sidetracked too. Just want to let you know this on where he went to high school, which I didn't know, but which really interested me, and you'll find out why. We don't dwell on it for too long. It's not quite caving related, but it's an aside. I left it in because I thought it was interesting. And full disclosure, we do get a little emotional later, remembering his friend Chris Yeager, who died in Cueva Cheve back in the early 90s. We get pretty specific on the incident and the body recovery. So even though you're a tough caver and you can handle a lot, this was a tough topic, and I just appreciate Rusty being brave enough to share it all. So you're about to hear a great conversation, fun, poignant, and like I said, just one of the best. I love talking to Rusty at meetings, and I knew he'd be a great guest. I just didn't know he'd be this great of a guest. Here's Indiana caver Rusty Riley.
My first time I ever went to a commercial cave is Merrimack Caverns with my mom and dad. Took me as a kid.
That was the first cave, technically.
Merrimack. First, yeah, the Jesse James hideout. You know, it's the big, the barns have all the signs all over as you're, you know, driving back in the day.
Oh yeah, well, and the billboards. I mean, the billboards are still everywhere.
Right, they're still around, but
yeah, I mean, it's like then, every other billboard on that highway. Yes. Between St. Louis right. and Branson is Merrimack Caverns. Right.
So, yeah, that was my first cave. But I went caving as a Boy Scout. The first year I was a Boy Scout, I went to Patton Cave. We went to Randsburg Camp on Monroe Reservoir, the Boy Scout. And it was a long hike, and I was a little kid. I don't know what first age you're allowed in the Boy Scouts. I think 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And I was kind of a scaredy cat boy, you know, afraid of, you know, claustrophobic and all that. But, you know, I went in there, and that was the first cave I technically did, a wild cave.
And if you don't know what Patton Cave is, it's like what, like an 800-foot cave?
Yeah.
In on federal forest land. It's a wilderness area. What is it
probably
called?
In the Hoosier National Forest.
Hoosier National Forest, Dean Wilderness. In Indiana.
Before, I don't even think it was named that back then.
It probably wasn't.
Or I didn't know that it was named that.
But it's a cool cave. It's got two entrances.
It's one of the furthest east. It's on a fault line.
Yeah.
And it has basketball-sized geodes embedded in the ceiling.
Yeah, yeah.
When I went the first time, I didn't see any of that. Me and my brother were out on his boat, and we did it another time, you know, when I got older.
You can practically canoe right up to
you
it.
You can canoe up to it. Yeah, it's on a pretty slopey, right down to the lakefront there on a real narrow inlet.
Mm-hmm.
It's so shallow that for a boat, we had to pull the motor up and kind of drift in.
Yeah.
Canoe, you could get in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's not far off the shore. You can see the water from the entrance.
What, maybe like 100 vertical feet up, yeah.
Maybe 50.
Maybe 50 vertical feet up the ravine. And
high enough, I don't think it ever floods out from the lake, but it's pretty close.
Yeah, it's really close.
So, yeah, I went with the Boy Scouts, and then
they do? I mean, what can you do in 800 feet of cave? I mean, did they just kind of crawl around in there? Did they go through that sinkhole entrance up on the top of the hill?
No, we went in just the main entrance of it and cooled off. It was in the summer, so it was kind of neat that you
So it wasn't like a caving trip. It was like, here's a cave, go in, check it out.
Yeah. Well, Boy Scouts, we would go caving. The guys that were the older scouts were into caving, and I caved with some of those later, you know, some of the same guys. We also did like McCormick's Creek Wolf Cave.
Oh, yeah, Wolf Cave.
And there was also one called the Coal Mine. That's been filled in. It was right in the main decorative area. It was like a little shell cave, low,
Oh, was it in McCormick's Creek, or was
yeah.
it? Oh, was okay. Yeah, there
back
was an old
then
coal mine.
It was there, and it's yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah, I know there's one at Turkey Run. I'm sure there was one at McCormick's Creek. McCormick's Creek's also got a cool old quarry.
Oh yeah,
that got some cool stuff there.
Oh yeah, the quarry way back there. Yeah, that's right. Along the river, close to the river.
So you started pretty early then.
Yeah, but that just those few times.
So was there a like a big long break between Boy Scout time and like adult caving?
Well, in high school, I went to Crispus Attucks High School.
Oh, and, did you really?
I was an integrator.
Yeah,
and
that's so cool.
They integrated the staff first, so they had white instructors teaching there, and as a result, the only white teachers they could get were usually ones straight out of college. So when I went there, we had a couple instructors that came from IU.
For some background, Crispus Attucks was a majority black, or was it an all black?
It was all
high
black
school?
High school.
All black high school
from
in
1928,
Indianapolis.
The first to win the state basketball.
Yeah.
Championship. Oscar Robertson
yeah.
went there.
Incredible history.
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, to toot not my own horn, but the horn of my employer, we did an incredible documentary on Crispus Attucks High School. If you want to look it up, I believe we've got it streaming online, WFYI.org.
Yeah.
I
saw that, and they showed a page of the yearbook with my, it didn't show my picture, but it showed some of my schoolmates. So it was I went there from 72 and was 76 graduate.
Nice.
So yeah, I watched that documentary. It was really good. I learned a few things I didn't know. The city was pretty, it was built to fail.
Yeah.
Initially. 1928 was a big Klan time.
Oh yeah, it was.
When they had a national convention here and marched down the streets of Indianapolis in their hoods in 1928, the same year they built this school.
Oh, my
the
God.
Thing, well, if you saw the documentary where the city was segregating or desegregating naturally in the 20s, they were all about segregating again. So they built that school to pull them out of like Tech, Shortridge. There was blacks going to school at those schools.
Yeah.
So they pulled them out and made all go to Attucks.
Oh my gosh.
And it was doomed to fail because they gave them no money for arts, sports, anything.
But to hell with them.
It backfired on them because.
That's a great show, social justice.
They
story.
Got some of the best instructors had doctorates because they were black.
Yeah.
Teachers that could get no jobs anywhere else. So it was like overkill if you went there because you had some of the best instructors. And then, as I say, the leading black lawyers, doctors in Indianapolis all were Attucks graduates.
Mm-hmm.
So it just kind of built the city up. But yeah, I had that experience. And like I said, a couple of the instructors were from Indiana University and were cavers. So they started a caving club.
Nice.
And in the school, which it probably would have never happened any other school other than at Attucks because they're kind of lenient.
Yeah.
And we were having overnight co-ed campouts. So it only lasted 1 year. I loved it.
How could you not?
Ruined me. My mother even said a few years back, she said, after he started caving, he was never the same.
Where'd you go for the overnight campouts?
We were doing we did Buckner's and Grotto and Coon's Cave and Salamander. We camped in Salamander.
Oh, man, yeah.
And this was handheld flashlights, no helmets, no knee pads, nothing.
Oh,
you know?
No.
This is 73 or 74.
So was this okay? So that was right after the accident in Salamander, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that was like 72.
Right, it was in 72.
Yeah. So
that was grim.
Yeah, but when that happened, then visitation didn't really slow down a whole lot. Then
no.
Did it?
It was a boom time down there at that
Man.
Time. Like so from all the IU students, you know.
So it was pretty common then to. be a group in there while several other groups were in the cave.
Yeah.
Especially on the weekends.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Buckner's was the big one.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, just down the hill from Buckner was everything. I mean, trap Salamander and Trapdoor. Yeah,
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 yeah.
So you cut your teeth in the Garrison Chapel Valley.
Yeah, and then as soon as I got my driver's license, I started going on my own thing. I had a little old 64 Ford van, and I would do my own caving trips with my buddies. And after exhausting the ones I knew and through the caving Addicts Caving Club, which defunct after 1 year, I happened into a gas station down there and found the Doug Love book. God. So
the Spelunker's Guide to the Garrison Chapel Valley.
Yeah. So then I did all those caves that were in the book. And then later, after I was out of school, I ran into the next, which was of Salem or Washington, the caves of Washington County.
Did he do that one too?
Yes. That was like his second one. That's the only two I know of. So then I went down to Salem area and do, what is it, Cave River Valley?
Yeah.
And Henderson Park. And me and my wife at the time ran into Lynn and Jane Miller. They were both presidents of CIG back in the day. I don't know which one was president when we ran into him, but me and my wife were doing Middle Cave and Mill Cave down there. And
yeah.
And I'd exhausted all the caves I knew and, asked them, hey, do you know where there's any caves? They told me about Twin Streams, which is down at, I think, outside of Cave River Valley.
Yeah.
But then they encouraged me to go to the CIG meeting.
Yeah.
First Monday.
Make it real.
So that's because of running into Lynn and Jane Miller. Me and my wife joined the Grotto. Like I said, I believe it was in 1982. And Scott Fee, Keith Dunlap, Kevin Strunk, I think was in the, he was actually in before I was.
Sure. So, he was. Yeah.
They were all, members. So that was some of the first, cavers I was caving with the Grotto.
Good group.
Yeah. So that, with the Grotto, some of the highlights I think was doing Thornhill. It was a Kentucky cave. It was discovered. It's in the Elizabethtown area.
Yeah, all right, just across the river.
Yeah, and another one called Big Bat.
Oh, yeah, Big Bat. There's a lot going on in Big Bat even today.
Right. Then after, with the Grotto, I got into doing vertical, I think, in 84, 85. First vertical was Parker's Pit, 100-footer. Mm.
Yeah.
My wife
was your first vertical.
And my wife was not as fearful as of heights than I was.
Ah, same here.
And I got kind of shamed into doing, you know, I had quoted years ago, I would never do any of that vertical.
Oh, me too. But I said the same thing.
I was pressured by my wife not being fearful. So we did that one, and then we started going to tag. That's after doing a few of the pits and Crawford area, Harrison Crawford area, then migrated down there, and that's when we started doing, I think Goof Free was my first tag cave. It's a good 247-foot
pit. Yeah, it's always good when you can break that 200 mark.
Yeah, it made me feel like, wow, I'm really doing something now,
right?
You know,
it's like nothing else I've ever experienced. And you were involved in some of the exploration of Two Bit Pit, which is down there, right?
Yes. That was the next phase after I was divorced and, I started caving with Danny Dybel and his gang. The Disciples of Dybel.
The Dybel Disciples.
So, I got invited to go down on a tag trip, just ridge walk down in Alabama. And, I think Tina Shirk recommended me, when I went down there on the first trip with Ron and Tina and Danny. And I knew Danny, but he was like a higher level that, you know, We're not worthy. That's the gang I used to cave with. They, one of them, Marty Atherton, he said, oh, we'll never be able to cave with Dival. And then later, I was, you know, here I am caving with him. But he said, what was it? Tina says, you're really stout.
Well, that's, yeah, that's high praise in the yes. caving world.
So, yeah, I started going caving with them, doing exploration, walking the hillsides that either had never been walked or had been walked in the past when they were just looking for big booming holes.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So they would walk past many going caves that were insignificant, smaller holes.
Yeah,
so.
And Two-Bit Pit was one of those, right? It was just kind of a tiny little,
hole. Yeah, it's down by the horse camp.
Yeah.
Down there. But yeah, when we did, I got recruited in on Two-Bit. Chris Yeager and Drew Packman were the first to go through that tight crawlway, the canyon. And Joe Oliphant sponsored me, is what he said. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, and they didn't really tell me much. So when I went in there, you know, I was thinking of crawl, so I had these Rockmaster knee pads, and I had a coveralls, and you had to bring a wetsuit. So yeah, I had two packs.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I got to that canyon way, I had a helmet, a ceiling burner, the feather flame carbide lamp.
Yeah, yeah.
I ended up having to take off my knee pads, my coveralls, the helmet.
Yeah, you got to take it. Doesn't matter.
To go through.
You can't have a really low profile helmet. You got to take it off. And
yeah, because you'll get your head one way and you can't turn it back the other way. You're pinned. So I had to lug all this extra stuff through that crawlway. It's like 110 feet, but it takes. On the way out, it took me 4 hours and 45 minutes to do that crawl.
Oh, God. I just can't even imagine.
Like I said, I went in.
And you're just tight the whole time, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's you're just hugged by the earth the entire time.
It's so tight, and it snakes its way through. So you have to contort your body to turn around to the opposite side so your waist can bend around the next snaky bend. Then you've got to turn all the way around the opposite way to contort around the next opposite bend. So I did fine going in, but
you're just gassed on the way out, I'm sure, because those are not short trips. I mean, after the canyon, you got a long ways to go yet.
Yeah, it was being explored. On that trip, I went, and we went to the sixth drop where you had to put your wetsuit on. You drop it, you do a 1,000-foot bathtub, and then you bust out into a stream passage. So we surveyed all the way upstream.
And it's a long stream. Like, that's the majority of the cave is that lower stream passage.
So they had surveyed most of it, so we got back to the very back section of it to survey. And then headed out. Well, when we headed out and made it back up what they call the warm-up room after the last drop, then you could take your wetsuit off because it's all mainly dry. Well, muddy, slimy, not dry, but you're not crawling in water.
Yeah.
But all the other guys had a change of clothes. And they didn't tell me about this, that I should do that. So here I am, totally soaked.
You're soaking wet. Waiting to climb.
And they're all dry clothes, space blankets, laying on their wetsuits as a padding, all went to sleep.
Oh, my God.
And I'm there going into hypothermia, shivering. And I had a little old, butterfly carbide lamp.
Yeah.
And I pulled this trash bag out of my helmet. So I'm in this trash bag with the carbide lamp under it trying to get warm. And finally, nothing was working. So I got up and ran in place to bring my core temp up using calories and energy that I needed because I'm at least 8 to 12 hours to get out from where we're sitting there.
Oh, my God.
We're probably.
And nobody cared? They were all asleep?
No. Ron, Greg, if you read the article that was in the '07
guidebook for the convention.
He said he was awakened by thot, 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 thot.
Rusty's Raceway.
Yeah, so they renamed the place Rusty's Raceway as a result of me. Well, when I got out, it was 34 hours time. And like I said, it took me 4 hours and 45 minutes to get through that crawlway. I remember, I was so exhausted. I would move one move and fall asleep. And then Ron and Joe, I thought Joe was behind me because I thought that was great that he was corked in behind me.
Right, right.
Since he sponsored me. But Ron told me, no, Ron was the one behind me and Joe was in front of me coaxing me. And I do remember Ron, you know, he was like, Rusty, move, you know, move forward, because I was just laying there sleeping in this hellacious crawlway. And I go, I don't have the strength. And he's like, well, find the strength. So I would move one lizard move, you know, one arm, one leg, and then immediately fall asleep.
Oh, my God.
So 4 hours, 45 minutes of that.
And you're just probably at that point just too tired to even panic.
I could have died, and I didn't care because I would have just went out. But you had five more drops, nuisance drops that are really tight.
Oh, my God.
Contortioning, so muddy that the ropes had been in there for expedition, you know, surveying it, so they were all slimed. So every time you advance your ascender, it would slide down about two-thirds of what you just did.
Two steps forward, one step back.
And I was literally standing, waiting for the guy to get make it up and above me, in front of me, and I would fall asleep standing up. I would catch myself falling over, and there was not a level spot in the floor. It was all just rolling boulders. So I'm like, standing precariously on a rock, falling asleep, almost falling over. And I made it out.
Was it daytime when you got out?
No, I think it was night. I think...
You didn't even get to see the sunshine. But no. It was probably nice to be out.
Yeah, it was killer. I went back three more times. I surveyed all the way down.
That was going to be my next question. Were you invited back?
Yeah, and I was a lot better prepared the next time, believe me.
Well, that lower stream passage, they called it Potato Run because it's the continuation of the Potato Run Creek, right?
Right, yeah.
The theoretical, well, it's not theoretical.
They did a dye test.
They did a dye test?
Yeah, I believe
so. So Potato Run is a sinking creek in that area, right?
Yeah.
And then, that's where it ends up, is in the bottom of Two-Bit Pit.
Yes, it's one of the toughest caves. I was on one with that... Marion Smith of Tag fame was tricked into going there, and he is such a great caver, but I saw him, he was falling apart. He was like, who's leading this trip? And I'm getting too old for this shit. And I saw him like climbing a mud slope, like we were all the way up or downstream. And he was like climbing up a slope, like thinking if he climbed that, he could find an entrance to get out. But we were as far back in it as you could be. So we had all of that crap to get out. And he went back to Tag telling all the Tag cavers, don't ever go to
Don't get fooled into doing Two-Bit up in Indiana.
I think Danny got a couple of more of them, you know, some of the Tag folks in there, and they're used to booming large passage, not that. But yeah, that was one of the toughest trips, toughest caves.
Would you say that's your least favorite cave of all the caves you've done?
Oh, it's not one of my least favorite. It's
no?
One of the most challenging.
Yeah.
I don't think I would like to go back.
So you look back at that in a positive way. Kind of like, I mean, I look at my most challenging trips as my best trips. You know,
yes,
I'm sure.
And exactly.
But at the time, though, it's like, why the hell do I do this?
Exactly. Well, the other three times I went in was nowhere near as bad because I knew what I was going to have to get into. I carried the little gear as possible. It was back in the mini mag. So when I got to the crawlway, I ditched my helmet and helmet mounted light, and I had two mini mags on lanyards around my wrists.
Yeah.
And I would go through one hand with a light, you know, and as the mud caked over the covering, you could clean it off with your thumb to move the next movement. So that was the way to get through there for me of my size, is mini mags on lanyards on your wrists.
And this was which crawlway? The
canyon.
The canyon. Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, because you can't do your helmet.
So, you could go normal caving until you got to that canyon, and then now you better get it together.
But wasn't there a water crawl called Neptune's Retreat in that cave to get to the Potato Run borehole?
Yeah, that must be the bathtub. The bathtub.
So I thought that was like 2,200 feet of bathtub. And was it easy bathtub? Were you kind of floating?
It was a trench, body-sized trench that you hand and knees crawled with the water up to your chin. So you're crawling in water that's up to your chin. And you had to let the guy in front of you go ahead, and you had to wait, because if you followed them, you would make waves that would splash over their face.
So you couldn't like hold your breath and tiptoe with your fingers or something like that? Or
yeah, you could hand and knees.
You could do that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then the 2,500 feet, there was 1,000 feet of that hands and knees crawl. Yeah. Then it would go to crawl in a stream, crawl in a bank. Crawl and, you know, more like a stream passage, you know, but it wasn't as bad as that 1,000 foot, just straight shot. And I remember when I was coming out, it must have been the first time I, on the way out going through that 2,500 feet, I was crawling through where you're in and out of the stream, and I fell asleep, and I woke up, and I'm like, my lower half was in the stream running over my body, and my head and one arm is up on the sandbank, and I just was so exhausted I fell asleep, and then I woke up, and then I look up, and then I realized where I was, and I was like, oh, my God.
Oh, God.
And I always tell people, I woke up from a dream to a nightmare. Because I look up and I go, oh, I know where I'm at. Oh, my. I'm about 12 hours.
From the entrance.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah, I still had that trench to do and the 50-foot climb in a wetsuit. And then that was before I did the run, you know. So I got there and, that was one of the highlights of my career is that one.
But you went back several times.
Yeah. I surveyed all the way upstream, all the way downstream.
Did they essentially finish that cave? Like, did you go all the way up one way and it ends and then all the way the other way and it ends?
It's finished. Yeah. I think there may be some off leads that you could rack up a few more feet. That was like the third and fourth trips. We were cleaning up some of the side leads.
Mm.
But the one good thing about the first trip I went in, I left my wetsuit at the Rusty's Raceway.
Yeah.
So then each time I went back, I didn't have to drag that wetsuit in.
You just leave it in. Yeah.
And then on the last trip I went in, I bagged it up and I got it all the way to the canyon.
Yeah.
And then I'd left it. And then we got through the canyon, and then here's Tony Akers. He came in, not with our group. He just came in the cave.
Yeah.
And he goes, is there anything that anyone needs me to take out? And I go, yeah, there's a wetsuit at the end of this crawlway. So he brought my wetsuit out, so was happy.
Nice of him.
Well, yeah, I don't have to hear Daddy bitch about my wetsuit still stuck in there. And that I had no reason to go back then. So I just haven't. I went in a couple times just to take my cousin and did the first five drops and got to the canyon way. And
yeah.
I showed him it and said, go ahead, crawl in there.
Just a little ways.
Well, when you start, you can't hardly back out. You're committed to keep going.
Really?
There's no way.
Well, because it trends downward, right?
Yeah. There's. It's not big enough to turn around in.
God.
You're committed, and that's what I thought about Chris Yeager and Drew Pacman when they originally did that. That's so ballsy to crawl in.
Right. I mean, to go in there and not know that it's going to open up.
Right.
And just be like, God, how far are we? Probably 100 feet. This is miserable. And know that you probably can't turn around.
No, I couldn't.
I couldn't do it either.
Uh-uh.
No way.
Oh yeah, your long bones. Greg McNamara has a lot of trouble in there because he's longer legs and just your femur bone is too long to do the bend.
Yeah.
You know? So it's terrible. It's a terrible place.
An exercise in misery. Yes. Well, you meant not to bring things down, but you mentioned Chris Yeager.
Yeah.
And didn't you go down to Mexico to be part of the recovery when he died? What was it, Cheve Cave?
Yeah, he died in Cueva Cheve in 91. What seasoned me to go to Cheve was doing 2-bit pit.
Yeah, really?
That was so tough.
Mm-hmm.
And also Joe Oliphant was the one who sponsored me to go to 2-bit. Well, we were caving down a tag doing the usual January New Year's trip to ridge walking. Me and I would go every year with Danny and we'd go down to find new caves and many others. But we were camping out in Sherwood, Tennessee in the quarries. You used to be able to drive your vehicle in the quarry and camp there in the winter. So even if it snowed, you had a roof over your head.
Yeah.
Built fires in there. And we were down there, me and Danny, and I can't remember who else, but Henry Gelsdorf from Chicago and Joe Oliphant just come driving into the quarry there. And they were down there caving. And Joe asked me, hey, Rusty, you going to go on that Yeager body recovery? And him and Danny and some of the other guys were planning the recovery of Chris Yeager down in Mexico. And I told him, I'll ask my boss to see if I can get off. How long do I need? And he said, well, probably about 3 weeks.
Whoa.
And I'm like, I doubt it, but I'll see. And I had no real intentions of going.
Right.
But when I got to work next week or whatever, I fulfilled my obligation. I asked the boss. I worked in service, copier, repairman. So I had a territory and, you know, it's hard to cover. You got to really plan your vacation time so you have other guys to cover your areas. So I asked him and he said, you know, well, how long? 3 weeks. And he's like, oh, I don't think so. So I kind of forgot about it. Well, that Joe Oliphant had been working with the Yeagers, the American Embassy in Mexico, the consulate. So I show up for a Monday morning meeting at work, and my boss, I see him walking up to me before the meeting, and he's got this deadpan look on his face. And I'm like, And he goes, Rusty, I got a letter from the American Embassy of Mexico requesting your presence on a body to recover Chris Yeager body.
Oh my God.
It says there's only so many qualified cavers capable of doing this.
Oh, my God.
He goes, I got to let you go. And I'm like, oh my God.
So he like fired you?
No, he was going to let me go.
Let you go. Oh, okay, gotcha.
He's going to allow me to have the time off.
Wow.
Well, that was not my plan at all.
Well, you probably, I mean, did you even want to?
I wanted to, but it was beyond my capabilities, you know?
Yeah.
I use the analogy, it's like, you know, you climbed Mount Rainier or you climbed some 1400s in Colorado, and then now I go to Everest or K2.
Oh,
you know, just a jump to the... At the time, Chebe was either the deepest cave in the world, definitely the deepest in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah.
And now it's up there. There's five caves in that area that kind of have bounced around. One would surpass the other. But, oh, yeah, it was one hell of a cave.
Man.
So Oliphant, again, gets me involved in
something. Well, okay, so if the listener's unfamiliar, Chris Yeager died on an expedition in Chevy Cave back in the early 90s.
91.
And he was at the time in his like late 20s, right?
Yeah, he was 23.
He was early 20. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was just after his birthday.
Oh, my word.
He had just climbed Orizaba down in Mexico,
mm-hmm.
the highest peak in Mexico, and then he was going to do the deepest cave. It was right at his birthday, and then he was killed.
It was a fall, right? Or
yeah, he became disconnected. His carabiner was disconnected from his rack. The rack was found on the rope. It was down past the lip. So something I've experienced where the rolling lock on your beaner will unroll.
Yeah.
And come unlocked.
Yeah.
And then if you like got on a ledge where you put your weight on your feet and pushed in to get around an obstruction, you may even push the gate open on the beaner. And then you may step up where it comes unhooked from the eyelet. And then when you lean back to go, you're not on anymore.
Just a perfect combination.
And that's what happened to him.
Oh my God.
Now I use a screw link on my...
Yeah.
Tony Akers insists on, well, strongly encourages that.
Yeah.
For that reason. Because it's happened to me that I know I locked that beaner down. And then I get to the bottom and it's unlocked. And I'm like, what? After so many times of that, I said, this is nonsense. I'm going to go with the screw link. Yeah. So much harder. I always carry a pair of pliers because... You know, they'll get locked, so you can't get them unloose, but I'd prefer that to coming unloose.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, that's how he died. It was a year later when we went down.
Because he was deep in the cave.
It was 2.5 miles and 2,300 feet down.
Wow.
It may have been one of the deepest recoveries at that time. Now, so with the mining and stuff, they've recovered people deeper, but... It was a mammoth undertaking.
So not to get too many details or anything like that, but how long was that trip and what was that like? Was that the most challenging thing you've ever done?
Yeah, that was the most challenging thing, but parts of 2-bit were still harder.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
But overall, the whole gamut of doing the body recovery, of being my friend, I was friends with him personally.
The whole group was. I mean, your whole 2-bit group and a lot of, I mean.
Right. There were 10 or 12 of us that were personal friends of him from the Midwest. Mm. And then there were Mexican cavers and that didn't know him from Adam. But we had 35 people involved with the Mexicans. Joe did a great job of coordinating. We got FedEx to fly the body home free of charge. We had all the paperwork. Death certificates and all the state, Oaxaca, et cetera. You had to get all this stuff in line. The expedition didn't want us to go there that was working on that. Most of the non-Midwest cavers were opposed to us going. And Joe was kind of a irritant.
Well, I mean, rest his soul.
Yes.
He was, when did he die last fall?
Yeah, he just died a year ago.
Yeah.
Looking back, that man had quite an influence on my life personally.
Yeah.
Get me into 2-bit.
Yeah.
And then that made me capable and got into going to Chevy.
Yeah.
And the American Embassy con, you know.
Yeah.
Or I would have never went. So he made it quite a point of getting me involved in that.
He's highly responsible for a lot of your adventure life.
Yes. And at the time I was like, you know, man, what are you doing to me? But now I'm so grateful that I was a part of that, you know.
Yeah.
It changed my life.
I bet. How could it not?
Nothing can be as hard as what I've already done, you know.
Yeah. You look at that. Yeah, that's what I love about caving is you can go on a really, really hard trip and be like, well, if I can do that,
yeah,
hell, I can do anything.
Yeah. Coming out of that crawlway down there in Two-Bit, and then when I went to Cheve, you know, it was tough. I was crawling out after we went all the way to the Camp One, and I was heading out, and there's only one little crawlway of any concern in the cave, and I was crawling with that ceiling burner carbide lamp. I had it has a generator canister that you put on your belt, and it has a hose and runs up, and it has a feather flame that's a good big, I mean, it's great for a big booming cave like that. But I was crawling through this crawlway and I was trying to stay out of the water, and all of a sudden I saw this light right up against my eye, and I freaked out flailing around. Well, the hose on my generator came disconnected from the headlamp, and it was on fire on the end of the hose. So I had no light but a little, you know, small. And it totally disoriented me. I had no idea where I was, what was going on. So I'm flailing around in this stream and in this tight crawlway. And when I finally realized it had also an electric light backup, so I kicked the electric on, and I looked back, and my canister was ripped loose from my harness belt, and the hose was flopping in this current of the stream, lying there. And I was like, man, if I would have lost that, I would have been in a lot of trouble.
You would.
So I grab it, crawl out. Now I'm soaking wet. I was perfectly dry from, you know, sitting around for a while. But that was a freak out.
Oof.
It was 2,300 feet of stair steps. So that's about 23 vertical drops of reblaze and redirects.
Oh.
So there was never one where it was a straight rope drop. Well, there was one called the Elephant Drop and Sack Newsom's Well, 500 feet. But most of them were offset, so it involved put your rack on, rappel down to the anchor, clip in, take your rack off, switch over, and then rappel down the next one. So five times times 23, you know.
A lot of technical precision.
Yes.
Wow.
Traverses, you know.
So what, on that recovery, I mean, were you just support, or were you carrying part
no,
of...
No, I did carry the body. When he died, they moved him up to a dry, sandy room that was natural in the cave. So they moved him to this spot and entombed him in a little room. I didn't make it to the body site. The only two people there was four that made it to the site, and there was this hellacious stream you had to cross to get to it. That was, if you didn't make it across the stream, you went over a 100-foot waterfall. So the two Mexicans that were with Tony and Henry Gilsdorf, they opted that he's your guy, you go get him.
Yeah.
And Tony and Henry were the only ones that got to the body and bagged him up. He was mummified because of it was a 40-degree cave. It was colder, 42 degrees
really?
Down there. And it was in sand, so Tony said that he was basically intact. And so they bagged him up. We put him in a body bag, a special waterproof body bag, and then on a skid litter. And then they had to float him across. And the Polish cavers that just happened to be down there and got involved in the recovery in Europe, they have licensing. Well, these guys were instructors for your alpine caving license.
Wow.
So they were like some of the best cavers as far as rigging and everything we needed. Because when we got there, the expedition had de-rigged everything.
So you had to re-rig?
We had to re-rig everything.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah. We had to start from scratch.
Oh, my God.
That 2300, 23 drops.
Good Lord.
I don't really think we would have been able to pull it off if it hadn't been for the Polish guys that came down. We got up to the closest village, Poplo, to the cave, and there were these three guys, like, you know, the Mexicans leaning against the building, you know. There's these three guys with these three huge packs. We come up there to stop to get some snacks before we make it to the final campsite before we got to the cave. And there's these three Polish guys. And we started talking to them. Yeah, we're here to do some deep caving. Oh, well, we're going to go do some, you know, Cheve. Oh, you want to come? Yeah, okay. Just for some kind of divine intervention happened, you know. Now, in the hindsight or after the fact, Joe had invited some Polish cavers. Hey, we're going to be doing this. So it wasn't, I don't think it was as
serendipitous
as it may have seemed at the time. I was freaking out. Like, everything about that whole trip was unbelievable, you know. On that note, the one that I can't explain is when I got out of the cave. You asked earlier. It took 10 days to move the body.
Oh, my God.
From the tomb to out of the cave.
I can't even imagine.
And I was there for 2 weeks. So, yeah, that's how long it took. But when we got the body out, and it had to stay in the cave, so it was in the entrance room until the officials came up and had to reissue the death certificate and make sure we weren't taking gold or silver or anything, because they're always worried.
That's like a thing down there, isn't it?
Well, Spaniards came and...
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But we got him out, and I just came out of the cave, and this bat, big old fruit bat, you know, really big one, came out, and it flew to each tent and hovered in pure daylight.
Pure daylight.
And then it came over and hovered over me and Drew Packman and the other cavers that were just standing around there. And I said to him, I said, that's Chris's spirit. He's thanking us. Well, after a year after, I talked to Joe Oliphant, and he said, well, it was actually, he had been talked about before, that he was having nightmares of Chris's spirit being caught in the cave and couldn't get out. And he said when they were moving the body out that there was this bat that was hovering along as they moved the body, and they would stop at each room to take a break, and this one bat would fly around and followed him. I think it was the same bat that made its way out and then came out. So that was, I can't explain that one.
Wow.
It's kind of weird.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
that's insane. Insane. It's amazing.
Joe said that after we recovered the body, he never had any more nightmares about Chris's spirit being caught in the cave.
Wow. Is that peace?
Yes.
Huh.
Yeah.
Where's Chris buried? He's in Indiana.
He's in,
right?
Coatesville.
Coatesville?
Yeah. I just went to his father's funeral a couple years ago. He's got this awesome headstone it's etched with the scene of a rappelling into a cave chamber.
Really?
And it's also got his state champion medal for wrestling. Yeah, it's a nice headstone, one of the nicest I've ever seen.
Wow.
Out in Coatesville, where he came from.
That's nice.
Yeah. Met the kid like 90, 89, 90. He joined the Grotto, and I think you went with the went down to Mexico and didn't do real well. And, I got a call from Ron. I'm going to pass him off on you. He's more your caliber, like a slight, you know. I was caving with the Rochdale Grotto. We had our own offshoot of the CIG. And we went to Leche Guia.
Did you
really?
In
the day. We went to... so we were kind
did
of...
Did you really?
Yeah, we did back in 89.
Yeah, right after they broke through.
Yeah, we went and measured the chandeliers.
No.
So I got to see the best.
You got to... Oh, my God.
And Chris was just had joined the grotto, and then he started hanging with the Rochdale Grotto, but he missed out on that one.
Unbelievable.
But then he was... I remember a good one that I went with Chris after... They had offed him to me, and me and my buddy Jay Knapp, we were down at Tagfall Cave, and me and Chris and Jay, and we went and did pretty well, and it was all just so many people there. So then on the last day, on Sunday, before we went home, I go, Jay, find us a cave that's further enough away that there won't be all these people from Fall Cave in, you know.
Right, right.
And he's like, well, it's pretty far, but Natural Well in Huntsville. I go, no, that's not far. We'll go. So we drove to Natural Well. It's like 180, and it was just me, Jay, and Chris, and me and Jay have been caving a lot together. And so we go to rig up the rope, and Jay rigs, and I'm putting the rope in, and I'm looking at it as I feed the rope in for spot cuts.
Yeah.
And Chris was like, man, you guys are really good. You so thorough. And he's like, he was real impressed to check each other. And we checked the rope and, you know, really impressed that he acknowledged that. And then I felt so bad that he died.
Yeah.
You know, and I felt like I was hoping I was teaching him safety.
Right.
And then it faltered, but it may not have been, you know, beyond his control, I guess, you know, but
I hope you still don't carry that with you.
I have post-traumatic syndrome as a result of that. I'm surprised I'm not crying now, but it's not unusual for me to cry when I talk about the Cheve thing, the recovery, but that was a good time when I remember, he just had that, you know, youthful optimism. And I remember we did it. And then he goes, can I do it again? I go, yeah, man, go. You
go
know?
For it.
And we're just sitting up there, you know, and we hear him, you know, big echoey chamber. And it was a good time.
Awesome.
I last talked to him. He was going to go to Cheve. And he called to invite me to go on a go to the Neil Young concert with him and Tina. And I just met this girl, and I said, I just saw Neil 6 months ago. And yeah, he said, well, we're getting ready to go down to Cheve. And I said, man, be careful. It's the last words I told him.
Yeah.
It didn't. Well, he did what he did.
Yeah.
So, yep, that was the boy. That was a kid on that trip. I was just talking back about it. The Tagfall Cave and me and Ron, or me and my buddy Jay, went to pretty well. And he was saying some stuff. And then my buddy Jay said something. And Chris said some silly thing. I said, man, you ain't nothing but a kid, you know? And then he said, well, that's what Ron calls me. So everyone was calling him the kid. And that's on his tombstone, the kid.
The kid.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
23, 24 years old, he's always going to be a kid.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Man.
When you die young like that, that's as old as you're ever remembered, you know?
Yeah.
You're never an old man. You're never.
You're always the kid.
You're always the kid.
So, Man, where do we go from there?
Well, that was my first Mexican caving trip.
That was the first. So have you been back?
Yeah, I went back.
What else have you done down in Mexico?
I went down to that same area, which we call the Lost City, where Cheve and the other five deep caves are.
Watlan, whatnot.
Yeah, around the Watla area in 2001 with Diablo and the gang. And I cracked a molar while I was up there, and I didn't know why I was feeling sick. I kind of bailed on the trip and had left. But yeah, I went down on that trip, and then I went on the project Sierra Mazateca with Tony Akers, Marion Akers. I went on the 2015, 16, and 17.
So you've been down there a lot in recent years.
This old age, yeah. But
you can still do it, though. I mean, there's a lot of, that says a lot about your physical state, honestly, because there's a lot of mountain hiking. Yes. I mean, it's almost nothing but that. There's a little bit of caving, but you're mostly...
It's mainly hiking, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 7 hours to hike up with a 70, 80-pound pack. Yeah, it was tough. It was pretty tough the last time. That's a whole different ball game down there. 98, I went to Chiapas, Mexico.
Yeah?
And I went to Yerba Bueno with Drew Pacman. And there was a guy named Ruben Comstock, that Mexican American, that has a compound down in Yerba Bueno. It was right at the time that Marcos, the rebel, they were fighting with the Mexican government, which is still going on to this day. But it was funny when we drove all the way down there, 2,500 miles. We got up at the top of the mountain there, and it was all foggy. And we're driving, and I'm like slowing down. I could hardly see. I had the window down, looked with my head out, and I was about to stop. And Drew's like, "Don't stop! Don't stop! Keep moving!" So then, when we finally make it to Ruben's compound, then he tells me, "Oh, well, they're shooting people up here."
Oh my god!
Like, dude, thanks for letting me know now. Well, it's probably good he didn't tell me.
Well, and you're here today, so obviously nothing happened, but right. God, how scary.
It's even worse down there now in that area, the Chiapas area.
Is it really?
Yeah. The Guatemalan border.
Oh, okay. So it's way down there.
Yeah, it's furthest.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a good one. The good trip I did on that one was there at Choriodero. It's a famous cave. The entrance on one side of the mountain. Stream and then comes out the other side. So me and Drew and Ruben went up there to do it, and we took my truck, dropped it at the downstream side, had a taxi, drove us up to the other side, walked through some pasture land with our wetsuits and stuff, and get in the massive cave, unbelievably large, huge limestone wall of 600-700 feet, booming entrance, full of logs, and did the first nuisance drop dry, and then you put your wetsuits on and proceeded to do like 15 plunge pools of 10 to 35 feet cliff that you jumped off into the water and swam your way down. You know, there was actually a few that you couldn't jump. We did pull downs. You had to double the rope and rappel down and pull the rope down. And it was an impressive cave.
Wow.
That's one I'm glad I've done. We also did a connection between, I may be wrong, I think it was Cerro Rabón and another cave that the Swiss had done a connection route. And we went in and did it and re-rigged. They had like little 7-millimeter rope, so... We went in and re-rigged with bigger rope and pulled their rope, and then we ended up using it for handline spots. But I remember this one huge backbreaker, you know, like 4 feet tall, and a slope, perfect. It looked like it was man-made, just straight ramp.
Really?
That went on for like 500 yards or something. Gigantic caves down there, gigantic. And then when we came out at the main entrance, it was close to a village that we weren't allowed there or something. So when we came out that night, we had to sneak out and be really quiet. Had to hike all the way back because it was a through cave. Went in one end, out the other. So it was a hellacious hike back.
Talk about adventure.
I remember we parked my truck by this, you know, thatched hut, and the local paid him a few pesos to watch her truck, and we'd be back 24 hours later, and we stagger up there after all those hours and hiking back up the mountain to get back to the vehicle. And this beautiful woman, local,
yeah,
wearing just a muslin dress. I mean, she was like a model, you know, beautiful. She comes out with a steaming bowl of beans. And it was like 3 a.m.
Like an angel.
Yes, exactly. So she was, you know, like, we paid her like a buck or a couple bucks to watch her truck. And then here she is. When we got back, she's on it, you know, waiting for us. Brings us out this food and everything. Yeah. Yeah, that was a good one.
God, I guess so.
Some challenges. I was involved in some cave rescues. Wayne's Cave, there was an IU professor that knocked his teeth out. He fell down one of those slopes back in that.
Around Camp 2? Was that when they trenched out the Why the Hell Squeeze or whatever?
I don't know.
The crawlway?
I don't know if that's, they had to do that. I pictured there was some. There's lots of ways you can either climb along the goat trails up on those high slopes,
or you can
find your way down and do the lowers. And there was one where I was on the higher trying to get to the lower, and I kind of leaned against the wall on the opposite side and on the slope, just kind of fell into the wall. If you didn't do it right, you'd fall. I think that's where he fell, trying that maneuver I did.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And fell and knocked his, I guess he knocked his teeth out and probably broke an arm or whatever. I mean, he wasn't as paralyzed from it. But
no, but.
That was another one because you had to get him through that long crawlway.
Did you put him in a stretcher? I mean, was he in like a litter?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And at times the litter was, you know, we had to chip and break and enlarge it enough to get him through.
Yeah.
And then we had a long chain of people passing him. I did the late Dean Meyer. He had these military field radios, and I was involved in rigging the wire through the 1,000-foot crawlway, and we set up field phones so we had communication between the entrance and that crawlway. And then we had to work him through that crawlway. That was tough.
Mm.
But then it's kind of funny when about Dog Hill Donahue, one of our cavers, what was her name? Betty Logan. She fell on that. There's a 20-foot drop, and they have a large rope like in gym class where you just hand over down that. And she fell and broke her leg, and we went down to get her out on that one. And that was... They all take a long time.
Yeah, they do. It doesn't matter where, how close.
So we took her out Dog Hill, and that was pretty cool because when I came out, the Red Cross was there. They had the truck, and people were applauding and handing you soup and coffee and stuff. And the next Halloween grotto, Halloween party, I was at it, and... this woman was in like a clown costume, face all painted and stuff. And we were chummy or whatever. And she goes, "You don't even know who I am." And I go, "I pulled you out of Dog Hill Donahue." And I couldn't really tell with all that makeup. But when I saw her, I go, I know who you are.
You remembered.
I remember looking at you in the litter. Kind of got her on that one. I know who you are. I know exactly who you are. Didn't I drag your ass out of that cave with the broken leg? Yeah. Let me see. There's one more that I was involved in. Another ex-CIG-er, Kenny Kerrigan, fell in Birthday Plunge. It's a multi-drop cave in Corydon.
I've heard of the cave, but I don't know if I've heard about this.
Yeah, he was, it's like got 4 or 5 drops. He was back, and they have these little natural bridges between the drops, and they're low. You got to duck down, and there's a pit on one side, pit on the other side. Well, I talked to him years later, and he said there was a bat on the ceiling. And as he was working his way across that bridge, he moved to avoid brushing the bat and fell into the hole. He broke his pelvis, and he was bleeding internally. And we got him out, I can't remember, like in 7 or 8 hours. And because of the internal bleeding, you know, he may have died if we hadn't gotten him out. That one, oh, my God. We got him out, and the National Guard had them get a helicopter to come and pick him up. So we got him out, and I'm like, where's the helicopter? And then they like radio, okay, we're ready now. And okay, Louisville. And I'm like, Louisville, they're just leaving now, you know? Well, they showed up in like 15 minutes. And this huge Blackhawk.
Oh, my God.
Is hovering over this hilltop in the middle of the
Harrison
forest.
Crawford?
And Harrison Crawford. And they drop the dangle, you know, the cable down. And we hook him up. And we have a tether line to the litter. And they start hoisting him up. And I don't know who tied the tether, but it came untied. And then you see the litter start to propeller and faster and faster. It was spinning like a propeller from the downdraft and all that. So here he is. He survives all this. And I'm like, God, we got him out. Now we're going to kill him before they get him in the.
Oh, my God.
So the thing's, I'm just picturing him slipping out of the litter, you know, but he made it.
Oh, yeah. My God.
So that was that. Well, that was the last one. I was also on that one at Spring Mill that the Marine was in there for 60 hours on the ledge.
Oh, yeah. Don loves telling that story.
I was just on standby. Steve Collins was the one who got him out or got ducked under the water there. At, what is that one?
Donaldson, Bronson Donaldson.
Yes. Yeah. That one's in Spring Mill. Yeah.
Yeah.
As a result, Steve Collins was the state's wonder boy, the Spring Mill. We all got to go in there and survey all the caves because of, they were so grateful to him. And they wanted to know what was on their property.
Right, exactly.
I got on one whistling cave. It's kind of behind that the blacksmith shop in the village down there. There's a cave back behind there that's miles of passage, stream passage.
Really?
And I believe it's not complete yet. And it's got going passage. Last time I was, point I was in, I came where we stopped, there were intersecting about 8 different passages coming in from all directions that I don't believe have even been touched.
That Crawford Upland, man, there's matter all of, kinds of good stuff.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I think I talked to Glenn LeMasters, and he said that they were going to start working some of that stuff again.
Wow.
And
that's
there's
intriguing.
3 or 4 miles already on that map.
Wow.
It's a nice cave. And I worked on some others with Danny. Breathing Hole.
Oh, yeah. That was a big one.
Blowing Hole. Smith's Blowhole. I was with Joe Alphen on that one. And then a little one called Rusty's Resounding Rock Drop. And one I discovered down in Alabama, it ended up being 456 feet deep, and Elliot Stahl went and finished that one up because it was so tight.
Did he? Oh, God.
We had to get some little skinny guys to go finish that one up. I think 456 feet. It's like the seventh deepest cave in Alabama.
That's awesome.
If that, you know, Alabama, that's
significant. Yeah, that's significant. Something else.
Yeah, it's a deep, very deep cave. I haven't been back to the back of that one.
What a rich caving life. Thank you, Rusty. And thank you for listening. I'm so glad to be doing this. I actually got to share a bunch of audio clips this past weekend at the Indiana Karst Conservancy's annual Indiana Cave Symposium, which went over well. And everybody seemed to enjoy hearing caver oral histories. But I want to talk to you. I want your oral history. Email me at alpineproductions@gmail.com. alpineproductions@gmail.com. I'm still banking up interviews to get me through the rest of the year. My second child is due in early August. Things are going well, but I'll need some extra family time. I got lots of great interviews in the can, but I could always use more. If you or someone you know would make a great guest, get a hold of me. Next month, my guest will be Johanna Kovarik. She is an NSS fellow, a ranger for the U.S. Forest Service, and their National Cave and Karst Geology Program Coordinator. She's got a very interesting story, and I can't wait for you to hear it. That'll be out June 1st. I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.